John chapter 8. We're looking at the woman taken in adultery in chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. And we have arrived at verse 6, where John intersperses a comment that all of this is done by the Jews and the Pharisees and the scribes, not in the interest of morality, but in the interest of putting Jesus on the spot. So verse 6 says, they were saying this, testing him. Now, in what sense is this a test? Or how is this a test? First of all, the meaning of the word. The meaning of the word that is translated, this they did to test him. The word test can mean test in order to prove good, or test in order to prove sinful or wrong. This word here is test with a view to failing. Their intention is revealed in the word. We want Jesus to fail. And we are going to contrive this incident in order to get him to fail. How, however, could this do this? How could this prove him to fail? And we will want to answer that by saying, if he says stoner, and if he says don't. So first of all, if he says stone her, or if he says do not stone her, either way he goes, he is in trouble. If he says stone her, then he would be counseling action against Roman law. Roman law did not permit the Jewish law to inflict capital punishment. The Jewish law provided for capital punishment. The Jews, however, were under Roman law and Roman domination. And Roman domination says you cannot inflict the death penalty. So if he says stone her, he is going against Roman law and he's going to be liable to the Roman government. If he says do not stone her, that would be action against Jewish law. We have an expression in English for telling the kind of situation this is. If you say, do it, you're in trouble. If you say, don't do it, you're in trouble. If he says, stone her, he is going against Roman law, which would put him in deep trouble. If, on the other hand, he says, do not do it, then he is going against the Old Testament or Jewish law, and the expression we have is the test involved, is they are involving Jesus in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And this is exactly where they are leading him in this particular context. That's their intent. That is what they plan to do. Now, Jesus has a way of responding to accusations. And he responds to accusations in one of three ways. Sometimes he will reply with a very barbed reply. That's a method. Sometimes he will respond with silence. I guess we could say no response. Sometimes he responds by stating the true facts. John 18, for example, is a barbed reply. Verse 20 says, Jesus answered him, and he's been questioned concerning his teaching. He says, I've spoken openly in the world. I have always taught in the synagogues. The reason this is a barbed reply is that he's standing before the chief priest, and the chief priest brings him in at nighttime and secretly. And Jesus replies, I've spoken openly. I mean, you by night, you secretly, but I've spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret like you. I'm paraphrasing there. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. Behold, they know what I've said. And when he had said this, one of the officers standing by gave Jesus a blow, saying, is this the way you answer the high priest? In other words, it was a very barbed, cutting reply. There are times when he responds with silence, and we'll look at the one in John, but we might also look at the one in Luke 23. Luke 23. And the answer here is the answer of silence, and it's interesting to see the context. Herod wanted to play with Jesus. He wanted to make a mockery of him, and we have in verse 8, Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. In other words, wouldn't it be cute if Jesus would perform a miracle in court or before Herod? That's what Herod wanted. How did the Lord respond to that? Verse 9, he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. Very important principle is here, and that is this. Just because a question is asked does not demand an answer. And that is important principle in all relationships. Sometimes we think just because someone says, I've got a question for you, that we're obligated to answer it. Jesus was asked questions, and to some of the questions, he didn't say anything. And if you go back to chapter 8, you've got one of those instances in John 8, verse 6. And what we have in these verses now is going to be the response of Jesus to the question of the scribes and Pharisees. 8:6, they were saying this, testing him, in order that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. The response of Jesus involves several things. Number one, his silence. And under the idea of the silence of Jesus, except for writing on the ground, silence in response to a question, number one, shows disdain. You are not worth answering. I have nothing to say to you. Disdain is involved. It also shows you are not going to control me. I am in control. It shows disdain. It shows control. You will not put me in a corner where I have to answer. I will not answer you. I am in control. Control and disdain are both involved in the way he responds. But Jesus also writes. His writing. 8, 6b, Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. Question, what did he write? Answer, we are not told what he wrote. And therefore, I, along with other expositors of Scripture, are going to tell you what he wrote. We do not know what he wrote. But that does not mean that we do not have in the context some good hints as to what he wrote. Because we are told whatever he wrote, we know the response that he got. And the first hint is this. As he writes on the ground, he says, if you're going to condemn her, there is a prerequisite. And the prerequisite is innocence. So the first hint is this. Innocence is the prerequisite. Is prerequisite a hyphenated word? Anyone know? Is it? Yes, no. Okay. In doing 1 Timothy, I write it and send it across for Teresa and Jane to edit and make comments and say where you're not clear. And Jane came in last night and says, I think you really ought to use this word, but I wasn't sure whether you hyphenated or not, so I chose a different word. So that's the way to go. Innocence is the prerequisite in the context for throwing the first stone. Here's a woman taken in adultery. Who of you are innocent? Throw the first stone. And that's found in 8:7. When they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, he who is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone at her. And therefore the words to be interpreted, he that is without sin. Now that branches one of two ways. Are we going to take without sin in a general sense? Or are we going to take without sin in a particular sense? If you take it without sin in a general sense, then it would be a reference to any sin. It would be like saying, all right, this person is guilty of auto theft. You want to prosecute? Who among you has never done something wrong? Anything wrong. And that would be the meaning. If, on the other hand, we take it without sin in a particular sense, you brought her for committing adultery. Hey, who of you guys hasn't committed adultery also? So the particular sense would be the same sin. General, any sin. Particular, same sin. And I'll let you reason for yourself in this particular context. They brought the woman taken in adultery. He says, who among you is without sin? How would you take it? Where would your mind go? Would it go to sin in general? Or would it go to sin in particular, the one that's described in the context? But that's the first sense that you've got to be sinless in some sense, maybe in the particular sense of adultery, in order to throw the first stone. The second hint is what he wrote, whatever it was, what he wrote was continuous. He didn't write one thing and stand up and say, hey guys, read it. He was writing continuously because when we come down to verse 8, he stooped down and he, continuous action, imperfect tense verb, he was writing on the ground. So what he wrote was continuous and their departure was one by one. Their departure was one by one. So we have in verse 8, he stooped down and he began to write and was writing on the ground. And when they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone and the woman where she had been in their midst. So that much we are sure of. Are you without sin? Throw the first stone. Then he began to write. And he wrote on the ground. And this old turkey split. He wrote a second time. And another Pharisee said, I have an appointment and I'm late. And he wrote the third one. And another one said, I don't feel well. And he left. So that whatever the writing was, it affected them one at a time. Maybe. Pharisee Benjamin. Remember? Holiday Inn. Room 401. Benjamin Jonas. You remember Liz? Good Jewish name. Elizabeth. And that could well be an explanation of what's happening. And one by one, they saw that it was time to leave, that we are exposed. And the reason for one by one is probably Benjamin figured that the Lord didn't have any idea what his old buddy Jonas was up to last weekend. And then he was exposed, and typical human mentality, Pharisee Jonas figured, well, the next Pharisee figured that he probably doesn't know anything about me, and they were one by one exposed. That is possible, we don't know. We are not told what he wrote. It seems to me like this, however, is very, very feasible in his answer to it. If so, it would be a very brilliant answer. Verse 10 and 11, you have Jesus' response. They've all left. And now you have the response of Jesus. He speaks. And in his speaking, you have a beautiful balance of two things. Number one, it is very clear he does not condemn. He says that. Number two, he does not condone. Verses 10 and 11, noting both. Verse 10, straightening up, Jesus said to her, Woman, where are they? Does no one condemn you? And she said, No one, Lord. And Jesus said, Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. And the important thing to note at that point is the condemnation is a reference to outward punishment, not moral guilt. The reference is to outward punishment, not inward guilt. And the reason we know that is in the last part of verse 11, from now on, sin no more. He does not condemn, but at the same time, he does not condone. You're a believer. What's your mentality? If you see a fellow believer in sin, do you feel that it's your moral obligation before God to punish them? Jesus didn't. And he said plainly, You're guilty, 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 guilty. Don't do it again. I'm not here to punish you. And therefore, you have a beautiful balance between recognition, yes, you did the wrong thing. Yes, you should not do it. Or no, you should not do it. Yes, you should not do it again. No, you should not do it again. Whatever. You should not do it again. Don't do it again. It was sin. He didn't say moral turpitude or failure. He said it was sin. Don't do it again. I will not condone it. Neither will I come down with the club and punish you. Observation. Jesus is much less righteous than many Christians. Because while he did not condone, at the same time, he said in the very clear words, and they're found in verse 11, she said, "No, who condemns you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. From now on, sin no more." So it was encouragement away from sin, a discouragement of sinning, and yet at the same time, it was not the kind of attitude that condemned. Have you ever had the kind of friend that stood for what was right without a condemning spirit? It's a rare friend to have, but it is what we ought to be, and not have the attitude that we must also punish that person for what they have done. The Lord did not do it, and I take it it is a beautiful example that neither should we. All right, we're ready now for the next major part, and that is this. Controversy becomes confrontation. We're moving in the Gospel of John from controversy that exists in this chapter so far to confrontation. When we began in chapter 8 and verse 12, and we read, "And again, therefore, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." When we come to those words, we will proceed in conversation down through chapter 8, and we will arrive at the first time in the life of Jesus that they are ready to physically attack him. Because if you look down at chapter 8 and verse 59, it says, "Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." And you could mark down in your mentality, John 8:59 is a first. They have wanted to kill him. They have wanted to arrest him. But never to this point have they ever picked up stones. At this point, they pick up stones. We are going to move from controversy over him to direct conflict with him, and it's found in John 8, verse 12 through verse 59. Now, we said that in this section, you really have conversation back and forth between Jesus said and they said, Jesus said and they said, back and forth. And we will break that into four parts. One, treasury, dialogue, 12 through 20. Notice verse 20. These words he spoke in the treasury, as he taught in the temple, and no one seized him, because his hour had not yet come. And so all of these verses have to do with his teaching in the court of women, which contained the treasury. It was the most public place in the temple, and it also contained the menorah that lighted the temple. So treasury is the first discourse, followed by his enigmatic words, at least to them, in verse 21. He said, "Therefore, again to them, I go away, and you will seek me, and you shall die in your sin, for where I am going, you cannot come." And this is all the departure dialogue. This is all dialogue. verses 21 through 30. The departure dialogue. With verse 31, you come to a new paragraph, which reads, Jesus therefore was saying to those Jews who had believed him, and he describes their characteristics, and they answer him in verse 33, we are Abraham's offspring, and you will have the Abraham discourse. And it extends 31 through 47. The basic argumentation that we have the right connections. And if we have the right connections, that's all we need. And Jesus is going to reply that the only right connection is me. It's the sort of John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. And you think you have a religious connection that will do something for you. And he's going to teach in that section that your religious connection has nothing to do with your salvation. As a matter of fact, what you think is your religious connection is really your satanic connection. And they will resist that. You can understand that. My mommy was a Baptist, and my daddy was a Baptist, and my grandpa was, and we've all been Baptist, and we've served in the church. Our name's inscribed on the window over there. We put it in. We put up the money for it. We bought the organ. We have a connection. We know the preacher. And we understand what he likes. The only thing, the preacher told me this week, said the two things that preachers like are fried chicken and women. I don't know. But we have all the right connections. And to that person, the Lord comes along and says, your connection is not Abrahamic. Your daddy is the devil. And he will say that very clearly in this context. Then there's the group that says the only reason he can do what he does, and we don't deny that he performs miracles, but he does it by the power of demons. And you have the demon dialogue in verse 48 through verse 59. And that's about as far as I'm going to attempt to outline, because it is a dialogue. It is, as we said, the Jesus said, they said type connection, which we'll see coming down in this section. So we start with then the treasury dialogue. Treasury dialogue, John 20, verse 12, down through verse 20. And that divides up real easy. It's this. He makes a claim, he gives a testimony, they object, and he responds. So we will have testimony, objection, and response. First, testimony, 8:12. Second, objection, verse 13. Third, response, 14 through 20. And that makes up the treasury dialogue. First of all, you have the testimony, and under the testimony, we'll divide that into the setting. And the setting is important, and the claim that Jesus makes. First, the setting of verse 12. Verse 12 reads, and therefore Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. The setting is this. This is the second great symbol of the feast. At the feast, there were two symbols. First, there was a symbol of the water, which we had in chapter 7. And the symbol of the water involved the daily procession of the priests from Siloam to the temple. with water. They drew water at Siloam, and they took it to the temple. And that was done over a period of 7 days. The Feast of Tabernacles, which we have in chapter 7, or Feast of Booths, as some translations put it, was 7 days plus one. For 7 days, the water was drawn at Siloam, and it was taken to the temple where it was poured out, and then they returned for more water. And they did this for 7 days. So you had a 7-day reminder of God provides for you. And it was to take them back to the wilderness wanderings where for 40 years God supernaturally supplied them water. And therefore every time you'd see a priest go by with the container filled with water, you would be reminded, God supplies, another comes by, God supplies, God supplies, God supplies, God supplies. And that would be the message that would be coming across day after day after day. On the eighth day, there was no water poured out. However, on that eighth day, you have the words of chapter 7, where Jesus stands up and he cries out loudly, in 7:37, if any man is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. So you had a dramatic setting for that, that 7 days it supplied. On the eighth day, there's no water coming from Siloam. Jesus stands up, are you thirsty? I will supply you with life, or with water, or with satisfaction. The second symbol of the Feast of Booths was light. And this was the period when the menorah was used. And it was the period in the Jewish calendar year, in which the temple was lighted day and night. When the feast was over, the menorah was put out, and you had the termination of light. That is the setting for chapter 8, verse 12, when Jesus stands up, the menorah is put out, there is no light. He stands up on that day and says, I am the light of the temple, of Jerusalem, of Israel. Not at all. I am the light of the world. And therefore he claims that he as light is not a local provision, but a universal provision. So the setting then, this is the setting for the second symbol then, the symbol of light for the world. Second, by way of setting, is to note where it was held. It was in the court of women. And that's found in 8:20. These words he spoke in the treasury. The treasury was in the area called the Court of Women. It was the most public part of the temple, but it also was significant for one other reason. That is where the great golden candelabra was kept. The candelabra was lit at the Feast of Tabernacles. And one other historical fact we do know is that when the 7-day feast was over, it was put out. And therefore, the setting for the words of Jesus is very dramatic. The candelabra is out. The feast is over. I'm light, and I am eternal light. Therefore, in that context, going past the setting, we have the claim of Jesus. And the claim revolves about a person. It involves a metaphor. And we're also told the scope to which the light reaches. First of all, the person. Chapter 8, verse 12. Therefore, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. And the focus on the person revolves about the construction of the verb. The verb found in the words I am is the finite verb eimi, E-I-M-I, transliterated, eimi. The important thing to know about any Greek verb that you look at is this. The subject is always present in any Greek verb. Now, what that's saying is every verb's a sentence. You can't speak a Greek verb without speaking a sentence. If you would say, this word, lambano, Greek is an inflected language, as many are, and if I would conjugate the verb I receive, notice these are all, even if you can't read the characters, you can note one thing, they're all single words, are they not? This is I receive. And I receive is a complete sentence. But it's in the verb. That's a verb, lambano. Lambanes, you receive. You being singular, lambane would be he, she, or it receives. Unique language in that every verb is a sentence. Hebrew is even more unique because... And if we were looking at a Hebrew verb, it would not only have the subject in it, it would also have gender. Lambane, you have to note by context whether it's a he, she, or an it. Not in Hebrew. Every Hebrew verb has gender. If I would say in English, the verb, past tense verb, went. What's the gender of went? Went doesn't have any gender. What is the pronoun in went? Went doesn't have a pronoun or a subject in it. It's just plain, pure verb. But gender is present in the Hebrew, and we have right here the word eimi. Eimi, what does eimi mean? It means I am. However, when Jesus says, I am the light of the world, he doesn't say, eimi. He says, eimi, but he adds something. And the thing that he adds is a separate personal pronoun. And so if lambano is I receive, if I want to stress the word I in contrast to someone else, I could add a separate personal pronoun. So it would have, literally, I receive. When Jesus speaks, the personal pronoun is added to the already existing verb that has the pronoun in it. So the personal pronoun is added. So he does not say, eimi, which is I am. He says, and you can catch this from English, ego, first person, personal pronoun in Greek, is ego. So he does not merely say I am, he says I am. And the net meaning of, or the meaning of adding the personal pronoun is emphasis, and exclusivity. I exclusively, I emphatically am the light of the world is what he is saying in his particular particular claim. Now, obviously then, as he makes the claim as to his person, he says, I am the light of the world, and he adds a metaphor. And we'll want to note, why is light an appropriate metaphor? Every metaphor selected by the Lord is appropriate. If he says, I am the bread of life, that's an appropriate metaphor. If he says, I am the light of the world, that's the best metaphor for this particular context. And therefore, we will conclude by asking, as we always should with any metaphor, is why is this a good one? Why is this metaphor very appropriate? And we will conclude with no answer. We will answer it in our next study. Father, we're thankful once again for your truth and your word, for your person, that Jesus Christ is in truth the light of the world, which means we do not have to fumble through life or stumble through life. We can have in life direction. And may we recognize that that direction and that light is not found apart from the person of Jesus Christ and his word. And therefore, may we understand in our following studies of your word what it means for Jesus Christ to be the light of the world, in whose name we pray.